5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the new Panic Room. It's the show other shows want to be, and the show that authors want to be on.
When I see my baby, what do I see? Poetry, poetry in motion.
The all-new Panic Room radio show is brought to you by HellboundBooks.com.
Well, good evening. It is 9:30 Central Time and other times in other places in many ways. That is the new Panic Room. And yes, that was, you know, I've been wanting to play that song for a long time. First of all, I mean, you know, the 50s, and I love the 50s, as anybody who listens to the show knows. And I didn't realize what sexist crap it really was, but, you know, it all about how the girl looks, you know, instead of, you know, admiring her for her personality and intelligence and maybe career choices. But I think things were better in the 50s, to be honest with you. But hey, I've been wanting to play that for quite some time because we have our own, very own poetry, literally poetry notion. And it's my old friend, Extina. Well, how was that for a segue? That was wonderful. Fantastic, I have to say.
Definitely, I think it was one of my favorites, although not quite as funny as some of them. I still, in my mind, I'm always, I cannot forget the, you know, speaking of 69, that was one. That was, I was like,
yeah, that was,
oh my God, did he really
a little bit Freudian, and then the girl who puts the trash into trailer trash was my personal favorite, you know.
It's the thing is, I'm normally a kind of reserved kind of guy
most of the time, but it's funny, as soon as it's showtime and I'm sat in front of the microphone, it's just bilge. It just pours out of me, just like suddenly, like the you know the cuffs are off and away we go, you know. But so it's all good stuff. It really. So how has your week been? I mean, I don't usually ask because, frankly, I don't care. But how has your week been, Xtina?
It's been good, you know. It's been good, but it's so. I don't know about everybody else, but it's been so hot. The humidity has been killing me. It's just like zapping my energy, and so I've been taking a lot of naps.
And that's different.
You know, I know you're going to say that. I know you are. I don't know. It feels a lot different. It does. You know, today I got to a point where I was like, I felt like I was hibernating, like I was a bear or something going to sleep because I could not go any further. I had to take a nap. And,
it must be something in the air. I mean, it's been, we've had the humidity, we've had a lot of rain here in Houston this past week.
We haven't had rain.
I've and it's not often I think maybe it's as well because we're back into the full flow of the kids back at school and all the rest of it, and I get to 11 midday and I'm flagging, bearing in mind I've been up since 6, you know, so, and I'm flagging, and I'll just close my eyes for, and I finally have it's a toss-up, to be honest. So it's either a monster or a 20-minute nap, and they both have pretty much. Sometimes I have to have a monster just to get to the couch to have my 20-minute nap. You know, so it's like that. But it's. I think what? Sorry, you going to say something important?
I was trying to interrupt
probably
while
not.
You're talking. Yeah. 2 days in a row, though, I've decided I'm just going to take half an hour, 45-minute nap before my baseball game, and the next thing I know, it's been 2 hours, and I'm waking up thinking, where am I? What century is this? You know?
I know.
But I do feel better afterwards.
I've had people say, oh, you know, the best thing you can do is start feeling tired. Go for a brisk walk. Then I'm even more tired when I get back.
Yes.
Plus, this is Houston, and if I go out, as an Englishman, if I go out in the middle of the day in Houston in summer for a 20-minute walk, I will die. It will kill me. Seriously, I will just shrivel up and die, you know, because it's just so fucking hot.
Yes, enjoying the heat, but before we know it, it's going to be cool again, and then everybody's going to be complaining that it's too cold.
Well,
although
you
know, I'm not one of them.
We don't get
them.
That in Houston. We it's hot, then it's cold for a week, and it's hot again. You know, it's just pretty much constant. You know, I think this year we had. I think this year we had a bit of snow, but was that last year? I'm losing track, to be honest with you. But it's just hot all the time. Even when it's cold, it's hot. You know what I mean?
I do. I lived in Florida for many years, and that was crap, and I'll never go back. I was a friend of mine who recently moved to Tennessee as well. She was talking about the difference in weather and how just freaking, you know, how horribly hot it was. And, you know, I will never go back. I hated the weather. I seriously did. It was like living in hell, and you know, I'm figuring I'm probably going to go there anyway, so I want to stay as far away.
You could go to Florida. That's why I think that's why people retire to Florida, because you know it's the closest thing to hell, and they sort of getting some practice acclimatizing.
Is that what it is?
Acclimatizing. That could well be it.
It had the kind of heat where you can't even step outside without you just feeling like, you know, like you can't breathe at all.
I went to New Orleans a couple of years ago, and that takes humidity to a whole new level. It would take the breath out of your lungs. Sweat would just, you would step outside for 2 minutes and the sweat would be dripping off you. But, good music.
Yeah.
It was good music.
I guess.
So that was well
worth it. I was just going to ask that. Yeah.
It was.
I don't know.
It was worth it for the music. I enjoyed that. But, So, it has been a week. We had all the, I heard, sadly, Burt Reynolds died today, which is, he died, and he was one of these people that I honestly thought he'd already died, to be honest.
That could be the Mandela effect, you know. Do you believe in the whole Mandela effect? We should devote it
yes,
to.
Yes, it does happen. Yeah. You know, you just like, your brain plays these little tricks. But yeah, I honestly thought Bert died a while ago. In fact, the last thing I saw him on, he popped up on an episode of Archer as the love interest to Archer's mum. He actually played, obviously voiced it, Bert Reynolds. But apparently he's in an upcoming Tarantino film that's not actually out yet. So so there's that. We had, obviously, Aretha Franklin.
Yeah.
Bless
yeah.
her. Again, there's somebody else I honestly genuinely thought had already died. and I think it's sad. I think what really saddened me about that whole thing was her whole funeral. It overshadowed John McCain's funeral. God bless him. Thoughts and prayers. And B, Aretha Franklin is probably one of the greatest musical artists in living history. You know, her funeral was overshadowed by the Ariana Grande boob gate scandal.
Yeah.
You know, and
he was
groping her. He was like, do you not know? Do you not realize you have got hold of Ariana Grande's tit? I mean,
the fact that he kept
saying to him, you have got your hand on my tit, you ass. And he was determined to have a fumble.
His hand. Yes, he kept repositioning, trying to get a better group. And then afterwards, I don't know, I had my hand around her waist. And, bullshit! Bullshit.
He had his hand on her breast. I mean, you know.
Yes.
Seriously. It's just like, it wasn't an accident. You know. You would, and if it was a genuine accident, he'd have moved his hand straight away and that would have been it.
Yes.
So, Ariana Grande, I mean, it was only a year and a bit ago, when, you know, she was in Manchester and we had the bombing. It makes me wonder, really. Is there nothing that Ariana Grande's PR department won't do?
Wow.
Because
I'm not touching that one. I, being
the father of a young daughter, I am very familiar with Ariana Grande's music, not her breasts, obviously. Seen her in Sam and Cat and Victorious, all the TV she's done. And she's musically, you know, I've heard that much of it. I kind of like it now, but
I'm not a fan.
No, she's good. She musically is incredibly talented.
I like that one song she did. What was it? The one she did with that other chick.
Jessie J and Nicki Minaj.
No, God, no. For that, the one before that is
a favorite.
I can't think of it. Never mind, I don't like her. Yeah,
oh, fair enough.
I don't know. I did like the show though. She was on that show, wasn't she, with Victoria Justice or whatever, right?
Yeah,
that
Victorious,
was her,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
She went
you
from
know,
there, she played the same character. She went on to Sam and Cat with.
I would watch that. My kids didn't even watch it, but I would pretend I'm watching this for my kids, but they didn't even want to watch it, but I was watching it. It was one of those.
My daughter loved that show. I mean, because it's on Nick. I mean, and we just in the morning getting ready for school, just flick Nick on, and you know, and there we go. So. I got to watch all of those.
Iggy, who is that chick? You know what I'm talking about.
Iggy Azalea.
That's the song. They did a song together, and I like that one.
Yeah. No, the one with Jessie J and Nicki Minaj is a good one. One More Problem Without You or something like that. Boom Boom, sorry, or something. Mm. Bang Bang or Zip Zip or something like that. I don't know. Musically, I haven't really evolved much beyond, you know, sort of 1979, to be honest. You know, when punk died, my interest in music went with it, unfortunately.
Right, when music was still good. Yeah, I agree.
It was good. 50s, 60s, 70s, best music ever. 80s were just there. 90s were just beyond me, to be honest with you. And since then, I just paid very little interest. So, so there's that. So there's that. So, hey, the only reason I'm doing the show tonight, it was either this or switch out the Borcock in my toilet. So I've no idea what is going on, to be honest. So what's going on, Extine? Do tell.
Do tell. Well, our first guest we have is Kelly Evans, and she is a historical horror author. And I promise that I will not ask her when her book is set in, you know, because I...
How contemporary are characters, you know? It did happen. You're a writer of contemporary horror, so when is it set? Excellent. Well done.
The blurb sounded like, I don't know, futuristic or something. It happened one time.
It's like Me and the Handmaid's Tale, which I am thoroughly enjoying, by the way. I'm sort of halfway through season two now, and it is awesome, awesome, awesome. You know, thinking it was a historical period piece. I thought, I'm not watching that.
I think that's part of the reason I haven't tried it yet, even though people keep telling me to.
Oh, you should. It is phenomenal. Yeah. It is excellent. You will be hooked. So there. I'm guessing we should bring her on, do you think? You can ask her. Without further ado, as the French never say, it's got to be Kelly Evans, I guess. Kelly, are you there?
I'm here. Yeah. Can I just say that you know more about Ariana Grande than anybody I know? Like, I wouldn't know an Ariana Grande song if it bit me in the ass. I mean, seriously.
Well, like you said, because I have a 9-year-old daughter, so my job.
I was killing myself laughing over here. Especially, what's wrong with the 80s? Come on, there was some good stuff in the 80s.
No, what was good about the 80s?
80s hair bands.
Big hair.
80s hair bands. Come on now. That was awesome. Mm. Exactly. Mm.
David Bowie has some interesting stuff in the 80s as well.
No, I think he peaked in sort of 1968, to be honest.
Who doesn't love Guns N' Roses and Poison and Aerosmith, and I can go on.
Oh yeah,
and
come on, Aerosmith. Yeah, Aerosmith.
Extina, I will dummy you. You know I can do that. I am capable.
I know.
So I don't know. Apology for Kelly. I was reading the blurb and I read that you're an author of hysterical horror, so I was expecting a good old laugh. But then I read it's about the Black Death, and there's nothing funny about the Black Death, to be honest. So,
I guess.
A bit deflated.
It's like anything. You know how you wait a few years and then you make jokes about it and then you kind of say, oh, too soon? I mean, why wouldn't the medievalist people have done that as well? I mean, a few years after the Black Death, they were probably joking around about it as well, making inappropriate comments.
I think your medieval stand-up comedians were probably joking about it at the time.
Oh, probably.
Because that is how, you know, we as human beings deal with things. You know, all these people, oh, it's bad. With all the political correctness now where you can't say this, you've got to offend them, and da-da-da-da-da. It's just bullshit. You know, that's how we deal with stuff. And if people get offended, tough.
Right,
really.
And people have always had a sense of humor. They've always used a sense of humor to deal with any sort of tragedy. It happens. It's just like people blurt things out. It's human nature. So just because we do it doesn't mean people back then didn't do it as well. We're just like them.
Yeah.
Except we're
even
alive
now.
And they all died of black plague.
Well, then they're dead. Yeah. Well, yeah.
I remember we were told back in my high school days that it was like a third of Europe died. And it set human history back by at least 100 years, which means that had it not been for the plague, we would have had flying cars by now. But I read an interesting story a while ago, was that initially they thought it was carried by cats. So what did they do? They killed all the cats off.
Yeah.
And it was the cats that were killing the rats, that were carrying the fleas, that carried the plague, that were keeping it at base,
yep.
Of course. So, yes, yeah, serves you right. Be honest.
Right. I totally had one of those, the old lady who swallowed the fly. I had one of those moments just then. I was going to start singing.
To be fair, I think by the time she got to the dog, she'd have been full, personally speaking. But
well,
who knows?
If you read the book, it doesn't say she did it all in one sitting. She could have spread it out over a week or two. I mean, that horse that would have lasted at least 3 weeks, right?
I never thought of it like that. That's a good point.
I mean, to be fair, even a good sized dog would last. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, and you know, another weird thing that you might not know, you know the Humpty Dumpty thing, it never says he's an egg in the poem, ever.
No, no.
How freaky is that?
And apparently, we were taught that Jack and Jill is actually a take on virginity.
Seriously?
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a take on virginity. It was a very progressive Church of England school I went to, obviously, but there's a lot of hidden meaning. I mean, Ring a Ring of Roses is actually, funnily enough, about the Great Plague.
No, that's one of those things that everybody, like everybody thinks that no one could drink water back in the old days because it was polluted. No, it's actually, if you look at the second verse, it has nothing to do with the plague. It's actually about this old French dance that you used to do around a tree. And it was all,
uh-huh.
Yeah, it's actually not. Yeah. If you look at it, I'm sure Wikipedia has it. But there's a second verse to it that no one knows.
I didn't know the second verse, to be honest.
I do remember talking about this when we were on, we were both on the Dead Man's Tomb podcast
Deadman's,
together.
Yeah.
I remember hearing you talk about that, and that was kind of cool. I mean, it does make it not quite as fun to you know, well, I don't know if it's fun is the right word.
I think we read the second verse on that show. Yeah, whenever Jesse wants a medieval person on, he gives me a call. Well, I know all the gruesome stuff about medieval stuff. I mean, it's not all just battles and kings and queens and stuff. There's all kinds of juicy stuff as well.
Yeah. So is that why you choose to write historical horror? Because you're particularly interested in that era?
I'm kind of torn as a writer because I love horror. I've loved horror since I was a kid. I used to watch TV with my dad. It's something called Sci-Fi Theater. It was a Buffalo channel. And it used to show all the really old horror movies, like all the Godzillas and all the old Frankensteins and all that kind of stuff. And then as I grew up, I got a keen interest in horror, in history. So it's kind of hard to kind of combine the two, but then I figured out a way to do it with these books that take place in the Black Death.
Wow.
That is brilliant. And I mean, I've got to ask, it's funny if a year ago, 2 years ago, I was asked to beta read a historical novel. I'm not quite sure when it was set because it sort of dotted between. I think we've got the dates a bit mixed up. It was supposed to be around the Great Plague, but it wasn't. You know, unless you got the dates wrong. One of the things that how difficult is it for you when you're writing? Is it to ignore sort of, you know, common culture, pop culture, even modern day lexicon? Because I mean, there's one thing that stood out. She'd written something about something sounding like a rattlesnake. Yeah. And this was set in the 1300s when America wasn't invented and nobody knew what a rattlesnake. And he just pulled me straight out of the story. And then there was another thing she mentioned, something sounding like a machine gun. And it's like, okay, for the modern reader, I get that. But it brought me straight out of the 1300s. And I mean, how difficult is that for you, Kelly?
Well, I write straightforward historical fiction as well. So I kind of, and actually I got invited to your alma mater to speak at the last year's medieval congress. So I kind of, half of me is always in the Middle Ages, even if I'm walking around, you know, the supermarket or anything. So, like, probably actually 3/4 of me is always in the Middle Ages. So I kind of think that way anyway. But it's funny to say that because I was so conscious about putting new words. I actually, anytime anything felt like it might have been a little bit too modern, I actually went and looked it up in the dictionary and made sure that the word existed before 1400. So I actually did the entire first book like that. And I gave myself a little bit of a break and didn't quite do it with the second book, but I still made sure there was nothing that would pull someone out because it was completely modern. I'm very kind of anal about that. Even though it's
that's good.
My main character's he's a monk, but he's also a physician, and I went through medical books from the time. I've got so many medical books from Anglo-Saxon times and medieval times. It's actually kind of cool looking through them and looking at all the weird cures. But I made sure all of the medicine in the book is absolutely accurate. All of the clothing,
brilliant.
All of the, you know, all that stuff is accurate. So the only thing that's not accurate is the zombies, I guess.
Well, you don't know. There may have been zombies. You know?
Well, there you
right.
go. Yeah, well, I tell it from the point of view is it starts as it's modern times and there's a zombie outbreak and they find this old journal from this month from the 1300s and then it's kind of they read through the journal and that's what you're doing. You're reading through this journal and they try and find a cure for this zombie disease. So I kind of had to make sure that it was completely medieval sounding.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. That's brilliant.
But I didn't want to bore people as well, so I had to make sure that there was, you know, plenty of gore in there.
I always find the research part so fascinating. I really do. I know that even in my own writing, that was always one of my most favorite parts of, you know, was the doing the research. And I always remember we did have a guest on the show one time, and I forget what the subject matter was, but I was so, you know, interested to know, you know, how much research he did, and because that was exciting to me. And she was like, no, you know, I really didn't do any research. I'm like, oh, man, you know, because that to me is the cool part is to, you know, I guess learn. I guess that's, you know, my way of even learning new things, even if it's just, you know, in fiction, because, I don't know, I love that process, the research.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. I love doing the research. I did, for my Anglo-Saxon books, for the first one, I did about a year's worth of research for this for the horror stuff. I'd already kind of gotten used to the medieval stuff, so I did about 6 months worth. But yeah, I loved it. I loved studying this stuff.
I think that's one of the great things I think about this job is that, you know, you never stop learning, you know, and like you say, you're researching stuff and you're reading, and you know, I'm with you. I mean, I thoroughly enjoy that. You know, it's nice to have something. Even it's funny if I'm actually writing a novel at the moment, and it's set in Philadelphia, which I've never been. So just doing research about the city, about its proximity to the coast, about the weather, and just learning about stuff like that. You know, I think I've said this on the show before. I mean, it makes me sound old. You know, schools today do not instill in children that love of learning. We had it.
No.
We had that, you know, we were taught the love of learning. We loved picking up books and that. And now they just instantly, it's there. You know, I want to know about that. And they'll Google it or whatever, and it's there or whatever. And they're spoon-fed it. They're not taught how to look things up and how to learn about things.
I think it depends on the teacher, because my husband's actually a teacher. And he has kids that are, I think last year he was teaching grade 4, 3-4 or something like that. And by the end of the class year, he had kids that were in high school reading levels just because he instilled in them a love of reading. And they just went out and got their own books and stuff. So I think it really, really depends on the teacher. Now, obviously, I'm in Canada, so we have different like boards of education and that kind of stuff. And I think they give teachers quite a lot of freedom here. As long as you teach X, Y, and Z concepts, you can use any sources you want. And he's got the kids reading Lord of the Flies in grade 3, you know, things like that. So
awesome. Yeah.
He also reads to them for, you know, at least a half an hour every single day. He makes time for that. And he's just bringing up a whole bunch of kids that are just in love with learning. So I really think it depends on the teacher.
Yeah, it may be. I mean, certainly here, I mean, they are that restricted. We had issues with he was freshman high school last year with his French teacher, who, to be fair, and if you're listening, Mr. French teacher, you're a dick. who I went I, 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 sorry, Le Dick. I went through to the school to sit down. I said, I want to sit down with this ass. I need to. So I sat down with him and the assistant principal. And, you know, he's saying the issue was cell phones. And my boy's saying, well, I finished my work in like half an hour, so I just got my cell phone out. And the big issue was actually the teacher was always on his cell phone in class. So I said, well, yeah, okay, if cell phone's not allowed, that's fine. Give him something to do.
Yeah.
I want you to, you, and I said to the, I looked him in the face, I said, you tell me, you recommend books that he can read, because that's how we work. It's good. You finish your work, you got your reading book out, and you sat and read quietly till the lesson ended.
Yep.
And no word of a lie, the French teacher, the district doesn't allow me to recommend books.
Oh, really?
I laughed in his stupid little. Seriously, and in the end, I tell you, by the time I finished, he recommended some damn books. But seriously,
yeah.
You know,
yep.
But they're that restricted with it's the curriculum or nothing.
You get good teachers. You get teachers that take the curriculum they've got and they run with it, and you get teachers that just, I don't know. I mean, in grade two, my teacher told my parents I'd never make it through high school, and, you know, like 3 degrees and medievalist specialist later. I'm like, yeah, I don't think so. So it just really depends on. It really depends on. It's a partnership between the parents and the teacher, and sometimes you get really very engaged teachers, like I like to say my husband is. I mean, God, he's texting other teachers at 8, 9 o'clock at night and over the weekends and parents and everything. And then you just get some teachers, unfortunately, that just they stick to the curriculum. Like I said, we get a little bit more freedom up here, I think. I'm not sure.
Yeah, definitely. I agree.
It sounds a lot more progressive than he. I guess we're yeah, we're still mired in the 1950s, I think, here. Not musically, so not in a good way. But
I was going to say the music
the
was good.
The attitudes here. Well, my daughter, she's been, you know, and it's just not me instilling my beliefs on her. She's just brought up in an atheist household.
Right.
Because, you know, we don't push God. And she's bullied. She gets bullied at school. She's got kids, little kids. This is from the age of like 6. Kids saying to her, oh, you don't, because she'll say, I don't believe in God. You know, fine. As you know, it's her right to say I don't believe in God as much as it is another kid's right. And I brought her up, said, you know, live and let live. They have their beliefs, you have yours. That's fine. Don't force your beliefs on people. And she's had kids, you know, 6 and 7, saying to her, well, you know, you're going to go to hell because you don't believe in God. Which, to be fair, to an atheist, and my daughter at such a young age recognizes this, is a bit of a hollow threat when you think about it. It's like. Bless her, she really doesn't give a shit. I mean, she takes after just fine, you know, just get out of my face.
I don't know if I'm generalizing, or I mean, obviously I have to go based on what I see on like the news and all that kind of stuff, but it seems like large parts of America, they're very divided over religion and things like that. I don't know. It seems like maybe we're a little bit less divided up here. I don't know if I'm being completely inaccurate or not. But
no, it's funny here. I've been here 8 years now, and you know, I don't get out much now. But you know, would meet people, and like literally the second question they'd ask you, other than you know, where did you come from? What's it like in Australia, mate? Is what church you do? And it's like, The big one with the pointy roof, you know, and it's like the big thing here. And it seriously, being an atheist in Texas is literally on the ladder of hatred next to Islamic fundamentalists and pedophiles.
That is mad. That is just mad. We're just watching all this from up here, just going, oh my God, I've got so many friends in the States, and I'm like, oh God, please. I just hope it gets better for everyone.
It's not even just religion here in America, to be honest. We can't agree on anything, even state to state and county to county. We just can't. I mean, it's definitely not just religion. It's,
I get it. We're complete politicos, my husband and I. We've got CNN on pretty much 24/7, and we watch, like, the county elections, the state elections, and the federal elections. We just watch everything that's going on, and it's just amazing at the moment.
Yeah, I say all the time I'm going to head to Canada soon. So. Do you have a place for
Come
me on
up.
Your couch?
We have a spare bedroom, as long as you don't mind all the weird books that we've got scattered around. So just let's turn it back to horror and get out of politics.
Awesome. Speaking of books, how was that for a segue, James? I want to hear more about
beautiful,
Revolution.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I thought so too. So do you have a reading for us, Kelly?
I do, actually. Yeah, I've got a little bit that I've selected. So basically, let me just set it up a bit. So basically, it's the Journal of Brother Maurice, and this is the second book. It's not really, you don't have to read the first book, but it's the continued adventures of Brother Maurice and his two friends, Fala and Hugh. Hugh used to be a squire. They're traveling across Europe to find a cure for this disease, which is the Mordecarni, the undead. And they hooked up with this bookseller who just will not leave them alone. He's kind of this fat, horrible guy, and he just will not go. So that's where we are. They're bedding down for the night. And then scene opens. I had trouble falling asleep. This happened occasionally. Whenever this occurred, I would close my eyes and listen to my surroundings, the wind in the trees, and the night animals waking. Sorry, I should say were Brother Maurice's point of view through most of this. To my companions moving in their sleep, sniffling and snoring, and to my own breathing. Tonight was no different, all the usual noises. Except, after a few minutes, some new sound added to the cacophony of the night. I was on my side, and without moving, I could see Hugh leaning against a tree a few feet away. I rolled my eyes around to detect the sound, the cause of the sound. Then a grunt, and I understood immediately. Martin was awake and up to something. Martin is the nasty bookseller. I closed my eyes and slowed my breathing as I felt the bulky man creeping slowly in the darkness just above my head. His movement stopped slowly, then after a moment continued. Opening my eyes a fraction, I saw his large hand slowly reaching for my satchel, only a foot from where I lay. As he opened up the covering, I sat up. Fala! Fala was up in an instant, and I suspected he hadn't been sleeping either. As I stood and Fala grabbed his sword, Martin jumped up from his crouched position and started to run away from us. We gave chase, and it wasn't difficult to catch the bookseller, as he'd only gotten a few feet when his bulk betrayed him, and he was forced to slow down. Turning, he held up his hands. Now, gentlemen. Thankfully, the moon was nearly full, provided enough light for us to see his face. Although he'd been caught trying to steal, he still showed no signs of shame. I see you're one of the thieves you mentioned. Fala's sword was pointed at the men. Now that is unfair. I thought we were friends. He turned to Fala, his mouth curved into a small smile. Behind his eyes, however, I saw he was trying to work out how to take advantage of the situation. A friend who commits a sin upon another is no friend. Tilting his head toward me, he now held his arms wide. Brother. Suddenly, a dark figure threw itself at Martin, stopping his speech. Fala and I stepped back instinctively, our swords still raised. Two other figures joined the first, and at that moment, I smelled the rot, the foul odor of decay I was so familiar with. Hugh! I tried to summon the knight, but the noise of the bookseller's screams did that for me. He was at our side, and soon the three of us had our backs to each other, forming a protective triangle while we surveyed the surroundings. Slowly, we moved towards the screaming man, but three more of the creatures appeared, and we were forced to stop and fight. I tried to move towards Martin to help him as I fought. All I could do was watch as the first Mordecarni that had attacked him tore into his face and ripped out the bookseller's mouth and tongue as the other two gorged themselves on his stomach. The man's jaw made a sharp cracking noise as it broke, then became detached, and the screams grew into agonizing, unrecognizable noises. Forcing myself to ignore the man's plight, I focused on the beast I was fighting and was soon positioned to strike. The creature sensed my movement and maneuvered to my right, just out of my blade's reach. Turning towards my attacker now meant I faced Martin and the brutal assault upon him. The first creature had joined the other two in rending open the bookseller's stomach, pulling intestines, muscle, and sinew. The moon's light made the blood shine, and I could see the beast scooping out sections of slimed, fatty material from the gaping cavity. Still, the cries of the man accompanied our fight. Finally, I had my chance. I raised the sword and struck. The creature's hoarse rasping stopped short as his head slid to the ground, followed by the wound-covered body. At the same time, Hugh finished off the beast he'd been fighting, and we rushed over to the bookseller. So intense were the Mordecarni on the feast, they didn't see us coming, and between us, we'd soon beheaded all three. Fala joined us, his sword dripping with blood and pus. We were too late to save Martin. I knelt and closed his staring eyes, remaining on my knees to pray for him. As unsure as we were about what had happened to the soul of the man whose body had been defiled by these creatures, I still felt it right to try. Standing, I took my sword and swiftly brought it down on what was left of Martin's neck, watching as the head rolled to the side. We all knew it was a mercy, this act. Better than letting the foul disease take possession of the dead limbs and cause them to do unspeakable acts. And that's scene. How was that? that's the end of that bit. After that, what we get is him and Sala and Hugh continuing on, and they actually end up in Poland, and it's cool because I use a little bit of Polish mythology. Speaking of the Black Death, like we were before, Poland is one of the countries that had very, very few Black Death deaths, actually. Not very
that
many people
great,
were affected.
That was great, Kelly. That was great. I'm sorry. I was, you know what, as soon as you got done, I was like, oh, that was so good. And you know, maybe it came across as that. I was speechless. So we're going to go with that.
Yeah.
It was so good. Xtina was speechless. So
that's awesome.
That was great. Yeah, right. That was really great. I was going to ask, and I'm always curious about this when people write of, you know, like, I don't know, vampires or zombies. What do you do different, you know, to make your zombies stand out from, you know, the modern version of them?
Well, my zombies are, okay, so when you're first getting the Black Death in my book, the symptoms are similar to what we call the Mort de Carne. So at first you don't know whether you're getting the Black Death or whether you're actually becoming a zombie.
Wow.
The other thing is that I make them different, and obviously other than them being in the Middle Ages, is they can be cured. So that's all I'm going to say, because part of the book involves finding a cure for them. Because in the first book, Brother Maurice's sister gets bitten. First they don't know whether it's the plague or whether it's the zombie disease, and that kind of a crisis point for them. So that's how they're different. Plus, in my book, when he goes to the library at the Vatican, he studies the literature there, and I actually mention zombie figures from throughout history, throughout different cultures, because every culture has this concept of zombie. So I threw that all in there, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, that is. And another thing I noticed when I was when you were reading and when I was reading along too, the names. I like the fact that, you know, I have read books where, you know, the characters are supposed to be a certain age, and the name that they give them is just like, really, there was nobody back then named whatever funky name you're giving these people. And I just like that, you know, the names of your characters definitely sounded like they, you know, they come from the time they're supposed to. And again, I just think that's great.
That's one of the things I make sure. I actually, I go through sort of original medieval documents I've got, and I pull names from there just to make sure that they're that authentic.
yeah, no, seriously, though, because I definitely, I want to be there, and I want to be able to feel it, and like James was talking about, how something would just pull him right out of the story, and there's nothing like having a 50-year-old named, you know, Brianna or something. There's like, no, there's no Briannas that are...
it's down to, you know, obviously... doing your research and being authentic. Like you say, if you had the 1300s protagonist called Kanye or something, he's just going to spoil it.
It. It will,
I like that.
So another question I always have for anybody who writes zombies especially, are you a fan of The Walking Dead?
You know what? The thing with writing zombies is I they don't do very well. I think people would rather watch zombies. So, yeah, we come to The Walking Dead. And you know what? I've watched season one twice, and I've got halfway through season two. I got right up until Laurie got it. And I just can't seem to get past that. I don't know why. I love zombies. I love The Walking Dead up until that point. I love The Evil Dead. I love all the Ash stuff. And children shouldn't play with dead things from the 70s, and there was a 60s movie called, I think it's The White Zombie or something like that. I love all this stuff, but for some reason I just cannot get into The Walking Dead. I don't know why.
Yeah, you know, I did watch for quite a while. I'm definitely not caught up. I haven't watched in a few seasons. I stopped when, spoiler alert, when they killed Glenn. To me, it was just gruesome. Yes, it's a zombie show. Yes, it's whatever. I loved him. I did. And fast or slow zombies, which ones do you prefer?
Definitely slow zombies. When they came out with that first zombie movie, I don't remember which one it was, and they were fast. It's like, no, that's just messing with zombies.
They are so scary, those fast ones. Oh, my gosh, terrifying. I would definitely prefer the slow-moving, you know, we could outrun those. That'd be okay. We can definitely outrun them.
Having said that, my zombies in my book are actually fast zombies. I just realized that. So I guess I have to go with fast zombies just because I hadn't even realized.
Yeah, you have to.
They will go after you. So, oops.
Well, I hate to say this, but we're just about out of time for our first segment. So can you tell us where we can find you online?
Yeah, I've actually got an author page on Facebook. If you just go into Facebook and look up Kelly Evans Author, or I've got a website that's kellyaevans.com, and there's all kinds of horror and medieval-y stuff on there.
Awesome. You have to promise to come back and see us.
Oh, absolutely. I had a blast.
Awesome. I'm thinking we should have like a whole show. We're going to have a whole show, and we're going to talk zombies and good music.
Yeah.
That's what we should do. Yeah.
We should definitely hear on.
Throw in some medieval medicine, and I can give you some real horror stories there. Then you got it. I'm there.
Awesome.
Fantastic.
I thank you so much, Kelly.
I've not finished with you. Because I know Kelly said you spent some time in Leeds recently.
I did. I was every year the Leeds University hosts the International Medieval Congress, and it's pretty much the Comic-Con for medieval academics.
The reason I was going to ask you that, did you manage to get along to the Leeds the Medical Museum?
Oh God, no! I didn't have enough time. I was only there for like the conference, and then I had to go back down to London. And I know I want to go back and see it. I desperately want
it
to go back and
brilliant.
See it.
It's brilliant. They say if they go right back to the old times and ye olde times.
Yeah,
and it is absolutely. So yeah, we need to get Kelly back on so we can talk medieval medicine for definite and torture
definitely.
As well.
I'll be working on it.
Medieval torture, it was torture at its very best.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Kelly.
Speak to you very soon.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
The Panic Room Radio Show is sponsored by Hellbound Books, purveyors of all manner of dark fiction. You can find the publisher along with links to all their available works across platforms at hellboundbookspublishing.com. Hellbound Books is proud to be the first in the indie publishing business with their very own app on both Google Play and the App Store. In the mood for something steamy to read, check out new erotica author Jennifer Lynn's website at jenniferlynnerotica.com. You can find James at his website, www.jameslongmore.com, and Xtina has an author page found on the Hellbound website. Don't forget to follow the Panic Room Radio Show on social media. Our Facebook page, Unofficial The Panic Room Radio Show, Twitter at Panic Room Radio, our YouTube channel, The New Panic Room Radio Show, and come visit our website at www.panicroomradio.com.
You draw straws for if you're mad enough.
Stop! Welcome back to part two.
Well, it is. It's part two already. Can you believe that? Can you believe that? Thank you to Kelly, who was fascinating. I could listen to that. Listen to that all night. Actually, that was good stuff. I love medieval things, don't you?
I do. Yeah.
Good. Thanks for that. Thanks for that contribution to the conversation. Yes, yeah. Yeah. It was all right.
I'm still drinking. You know.
You need to drink more. You know some. But it wouldn't be a panic room show without. We mentioned our favourite person, the Commander-in-Chief, God bless him, Mr. Trump, thoughts and prayers, Donald. And I'm going to play this because I like it. And I think it's a great tribute to a great man.
I really believe I'd run into it even if I didn't have a weapon. Nobody knows the system better than me.
Nobody knows politicians better than I do.
Nobody knows. Nobody's better.
Nobody's stronger. There's nobody bigger or better at the military than I am.
I love the First Amendment. Nobody loves it better than me. Nobody loves the Bible more than I do.
There is nobody that respects women more than I do.
Nobody builds walls better than me.
Nobody's in the history of this country has ever known so much about infrastructure as Donald Trump. Nobody knows that better than me.
Nobody even understands it but me.
Nobody can do it like me.
Which is why I alone can fix it. I have Ivy League education, smart guy. I know words. I have the best words.
You're like, I'm a smart person. It's this. It's not my salesmanship. It's what? This. You know what that is? It's the brain power.
I'm getting thousands of letters and tweets that I was right about the whole situation. I mean, I've been right about a lot of things, frankly. I should be a newscaster because I called it before the news.
I watch this stuff. You know, I'm like a guy with vision.
I have an instinct for this kind of thing.
I'm good at war. I've had a lot of wars of my own. I'm really good at war.
In my book, I predicted terrorism.
It's a rigged system. I think I've done a great service by pointing this out. I was the one that really broke the glass ceiling on behalf of women.
I think I'm doing the military a great favor.
Did a great job in Texas, a great job in Florida.
I truly believe that the first 100 days of my administration has been just about the most successful in our country's history.
It looked like a million and a half people.
Thank you, everybody. What a crowd. What a turnout.
I understand steaks. It's my favorite food, and these are the best.
It keeps me from running.
Can you believe it?
I love that. That is great. And of course, nobody does being a big dick better than Donald J. Trump. To be honest, that's one thing he is superlatively good at.
I was, you know, after listening to all of those things he was saying, does he truly believe the things that come out of his mouth?
Well, that is the thing with toxic narcissists. Is yes, they I've known plenty of them. You know, unless it's just me, I've just known all of them. they have particular ways that, but they do. They believe because they say things. They lie. They're lies. That often,
yeah,
it becomes
yeah.
their truth. That's why they can pass a lie detector. You put him a lie detector, and he would pass it because he truly believes that is true. It is a trait of the condition that he has. And the worrying thing is that you know that they feel that they are, you know, beyond reproach. They are always right. You know, I mean, again, you just listen to the guy talk, you know, and he just, yeah. And the way he will lie, he will just out and out lie. He will lie about something he said two sentences ago and lie that he did not say that, or he said something else. And you can play back the recording and he will still lie about it. And it's just like, wow, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a dangerous person right there. That truly is.
Well, the new book that's out, Bob Woodward, I mean, again, talk about beyond reproach, you know, as a political writer, you don't get, you know, he's political writer royalty. His book's come out, and he's been party to a lot of close-up stuff with Trump, and he said that Trump's close aides actually physically take paper off his desk, keep things from him to stop him making dangerous decisions.
Oh my god, that's
the sort of thing you would hear from some dissident, somebody who's claimed political asylum from like North Korea or Zimbabwe, that sort of place, Russia perhaps, you know, that we had to do this for the president. And, you know, like, was it Robert Mugabe is my favorite dictator, my favorite despot, I have to say, because he's still alive. I don't know how he's like 110, still alive, bless him. and it was funny because he would lose an election. And Mr. President, seriously. And he would just, what I call them, the Mugabe defense.
Wow.
He said, kids will do it. No, I didn't. And they will stand until they starve to death and swear blind that they did not do something, even when you know damn well they did. Yep. And Mugabe, Trump is exactly the same. And it's the same traits you're seeing with people. And frighteningly, you know, people are drawing parallels with Trump's presidency and pre-war Germany. In something as a lot of the racist attitudes and the single-minded attitudes and the censorship and trying to censor the press and trying to control, you know, abortion issues, etc., the religious thing, the parallels with Nazi Germany are terrifying. Absolutely terrifying, you know, and it's just where's, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald when you need him, to be honest? John Hinckley, you know, Wilkes Booth, you know, come on, guys, step up.
Yeah, we're counting on you.
Well, John Hinckley is still alive, so hey, let him out. Yeah, that's what I say.
Yeah.
<It's> just...
Wow.
Moving on. So next week's show will be brought to you from San Antonio State Penitentiary and the Russian gulags. Xtina will be broadcasting from the Soviet gulags up in the Arctic Circle in Siberia. To be fair, you'll not be moaning about the heat, will you?
I won't. Hell yeah. Let's go. I mean,
let's do this.
I'll just have to...
let's move on. So, hey, before we bring on David Clark, we have another listener. So, Renee, I know you're listening. So, hi.
Maybe
she should win a prize. Hi, Renee. She should win a prize for being our third listener, perhaps.
She should. Yeah, definitely. We should get
unless last week's new listener decided it was a complete bag of toss and decided not to listen anymore. But fair enough. Or she was a Trump supporter. She could be a Trump supporter. They just it'd be irreverent around, you know, God Donald. So I'm not listening. So the frightening thing, funny, I was watching a show earlier today because I couldn't be asked to work, and equally I was procrastinating fixing the ball cock in my toilet system. So I'm all toilets. Do you know, I forgot what I was going to say now.
Humor? You know, we haven't had
it
potty
might
humor
well
in
have
a
been
while.
About, we haven't mentioned poo, have we, for a while? So
it's
gone. It's gone. So I got sidetracked talking about toilets. which are great. So I think I'm going to let you introduce the next guest. Hopefully you pronounce his name correctly.
That's funny. I'm looking through my book now. Hopefully we have a really hard to pronounce name next week. And yeah, just for you. But our second guest, we have horror writer David Clark.
Hi, David. How you there?
Yep, I'm here. Not quite sure how to follow conversation of Balcock and a narcissist. This is going to be hard to follow now.
No, you're fine. As long as you're not a Trump supporter, in which way we will mercilessly rib you.
I am now the embarrassing Republican in the room.
Well, no, I'm back in England, but conservative, which is the equivalent of Republican. My political leanings are towards that. I'm not a liberal. They bandy the word liberal around here in Texas, Islamic fundamentalist, ISIS, pedophile, the guy from Subway, that sort of thing. But, you know, it's just you can be a Republican and hate Donald Trump because the guy is not about party. He surpasses politics. The man is just he's dangerous. He's just a dangerous knob, unfortunately. And he's over and above. Even his own party mostly don't like him and they fear him.
Has anyone seen the old Richard Pryor movie, Brewster's Millions?
Yes.
See, that's the kind of way I want to handle an election one time. Have somebody that really doesn't care, but they have enough money to run, to sit there and say, vote for none of the above.
Yeah.
Because that's what his character did. I'd vote for none of the above. You know, there we go.
Well, it's funny enough, I don't know if you've read the Michael Wolff book about Trump's running for president. And Lose to Win. Him and his cronies ran the election to really as a big PR campaign because they knew they would get book deals and they would promote the Trump brand and whatever. There was nobody on the face of this planet more surprised that he won than Donald Trump.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
He didn't intend to win. He didn't expect to win. And so it's been done. It's like the producers, you know, the movie, the Mel Brooks and the even less funny remake they made, and it's the same idea. It's just let's just run this to fail.
I don't think he wanted to win. I think it was a big publicity stunt because here's the biggest issue with him. Not to get too political, but if you've ever read his Art of the Deal book. Every deal, every business deal he's ever walked into, he has had the point of leverage. He has basically already had the deal won before he walked into the room. He's always had the leverage point to where the people in the room that he's walking into, they want something from him. As president of the United States, he's yet to be challenged to negotiate anything, really to negotiate anything at all, because in the political setting, that's not the case. You are in there to actually have to sway someone one way or the other. It's just not walk in the room and shake a hand. And so, he claims to be that great negotiator, but you really read what he calls his pinnacle, and this was something someone suggested to me years ago from a business standpoint, read it. There's no real skill in what he does. Everyone is, basically set the deal up before he gets there, so.
Yeah.
Well, he claims to be a great businessman. I read somewhere that when he made the Forbes top 100 list years and years ago, he lied to get on that list. And by being on that list, that gave him the profile to attract more investment money. I mean, he's declared Section 11 how many times now? Is it five? People say, it's part of business. But what you is all the people. I mean, I've had it done to me when I ran businesses in the UK and there's a company owed us, I think it's like just short of £30,000, which is probably about $45,000. And they just pulled the plug, declared voluntary bankruptcy, and we got fuck all. So for all those times, I mean, this is over and above all the people and the contractors that say Trump never paid them. These are a bunch of people who provided services and goods and that, who never got paid. He ruined lives, he ruined businesses, he ruined all sorts of stuff. And he just doesn't care. And he's approaching running the country exactly the same way. He's bluffing and he's bullshitting and he's lying and he's pretending he's... I mean, this all this thing about North Korea, I mean, he achieved nothing. Kim is laughing at him. You know, Trump, oh, I've had this... Yeah, he had a meeting with Kim. Yeah, big deal, fine. But what have you achieved? You know, Kim has... He said he stopped his nuclear program simply because he's finished it.
Yeah.
He's not going to give it up. He's not going to give it up. We had the whole doublespeak about, you know, Trump saying it's going to lead to the reduction. He's going to lead to North Korea giving up the nuclear weapons. You listen to what Kim is saying. Kim is saying he hopes it will lead to the reduction of nuclear weapons on the peninsula, which means South Korea have to buy into it as well, which will never happen. So nothing will come of that, and he's all lording it up, and I had this meeting and that, and it's all show, it's just all smoke and mirrors, and that's what the man is. And more people, I mean, the fact that the whole bunch, how many people, 7 or 8 of his closest people have just pled guilty to some serious crimes.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just one thing after another. I mean, how is this sustainable?
Yeah, I have nothing. I'm going to get more wine now.
David, tell us about your book. David's book. I've got to talk about a segue. His book is called Vigilante Order. The tagline is "Sometimes revenge is best served hot and brutal." Brilliant! What a great lead-in. Tell us about the book, David.
All right, so. But most of what I write is not a fantasy, you know, let's build a fantasy dreamland or something and, you know, zombies or anything. I like to take something that's kind of more of a realistic, you know, real-world scenario and then turn it, because I think that kind of makes it scarier. That, oh, my God, this could actually happen. So in this book, lead character Rachel, she has suffered a very brutal attack by an unknown, unseen assailant. She wakes up from it. And, you know, kind of goes through the post-traumatic stress disorder of realizing she's really lost her personal safety. You know, she doesn't feel safe anywhere. She doesn't know, you know, what to do to get it back. She's, you know, locking all her doors at night. She can't sleep with silence. She's got to have the TV on so there's some sound so she feels safe. You know, just, you know, the typical, you know, post-traumatic stress, you know, issues that, you know, victims will suffer. As she's searching to find her safety, you know, one of her friends, you know, grabs her in, pulls her into first a self-defense class to try to help her build up, because it's something that helped her years ago when she went through something similar. But in it, she meets a group of friends that they expose her to a new way to feel safe. And it happens to, and this is kind of the odd thing, I don't, with what I write, I don't push any sort of moral or social agenda, but in this particular book, it is something that kind of makes the lead character go through a very large moral question, you know, between right and wrong, and what is her safety, you know, worth, you know, towards the end. And this group of friends really shows her an option she hadn't considered before, and they help each other. You know, this is a group of women you do not want to cross. You do not want to get on their bad side. And they help each other, you know, regain their strength, much to the dismay of their, you know, their targets.
I love a good, strong woman. I do. I, you know, one of my very favorite shows when I was younger was Buffy the Vampire Slayer. You know, she was just so kick-ass, and I love that. I do. I love a strong woman. That's awesome.
And one of the characters in it, Joy, she's kind of like the organizer of the group of women. And to give you an idea of how strong she is, you know, I came up with a tagline a while back, but, you know, Facebook and Amazon have some weird things about, you know, not using profanity and stuff. So one of my ads was going to be, you know, Joy's a bitch. Don't be like Joy unless you want to be, you know. It's definitely some strong women and very, very independent women, but they got that way out of a need, you know, for survival.
Reading. Do you have an excerpt for us? I want to hear more.
Yep, I do. So this excerpt is towards the middle of the book. Rachel's already, you know, suffered really her depths and her lows. She's at the bottom of the barrel, you know, related to depression, feeling of insecurity and everything. And she's gone to a few classes, but she's heard rumbling through the friends, you know, that she's getting in classes about this. They're going to go help somebody. They're going to go help somebody feel, you know, get their safety back, help her with a problem. And she keeps on begging, you know, take me. And you know, they finally give in. Okay, all right, Rachel, we'll let you go. So this is as she's starting to arrive, you know, at where they're supposed to be meeting. So, all right. They step through a hole in the fence and make their way into the closest building in the complex. The entire structure has a dark and damp feeling. The sparse moonlight coming in through the various openings in the walls show they are just unfinished concrete, as is the floor and ceiling. There's a set of concrete stairs with no handrails of any type leading up to the next floor. Allison starts up, and Rachel cautiously follows, hugging the wall, staying as far away from the edge as she can. It is completely silent with the exception of the echoing footsteps of Rachel and Allison ascending the stairs. At the landing of the second floor, Rachel sees Allison head down the hall to the left and disappear into the first unit. Seconds after Allison disappears through the door, Rachel hears her scream, "Joy, what the hell?" Rachel steps through the opening for the unit, and as the breeze delivers a nauseating feeling that is reinforced by the sight before her. Her friends from class are standing around the inner walls of the room wearing some kind of dark clothing. Several of them are holding bats and wooden poles that are dripping with blood. Sprawled out in the center of the room is a man lying face down with his arms stretched out to his side. His head has been cleaved into several pieces with a mixture of red, gray, and white spots radiating out from him. The wet metallic scent of blood fills the air. Rachel stumbles sideways against the door frame. Her vision narrows into little cones and her hearing becomes muffled. Disconnected from the entire scene, she can barely hear the conversation between Joy and Allison. Sounds as it's miles away, but in reality, it's just a few feet. Joy explains, "He arrived early. We were not ready yet." Allison looks around at the floor. "You didn't even put the plastic down. Now what are we going to do?" The displeased look on her face grows to disgust as she looks around at the splatter of blood that stains the concrete floor. "I know, Allison, but what were we to do? We were only here a few minutes before we heard him coming upstairs. We couldn't say, 'Can you wait right there a minute? We need to put some plastic down to keep your brains from messing up the floor.'" Allison walks over to the large black duffel bag in the corner and retrieves a flat-nosed shovel. She starts scraping the front edge of the metal shovel against the concrete floor, creating a nerve-piercing sound. With each scrape, she removes a small amount of the concrete floor in the form of a fine gray and white dust. The dust mixes in with the moist spots of blood and brain matter on the floor, creating an odd-colored, lumpy slurry. The occasional bits of bone fragments add a unique texture to the concoction. She stops for just a second and inspects her work before announcing to the group, "See, if we move fast, we can clean this up before anything really soaks in. Miranda, go grab the plastic." Miranda grabs a large roll of plastic from the corner and unrolls it flat next to the body as Lisa and Becky grab two more shovels out of the bag and join scraping the surface layer of concrete under the blood splatter and other biologic material. The mixture is solid enough for them to scoop up and deposit into the plastic with a plop. While they work on the floor, Allison asks Becky to help remove the body. Rachel watches on as they expertly position themselves on his feet, or one at his feet and the other at his arms, and lift the lifeless body off the ground and move it a few feet over to the plastic. The scene is starting to settle into Rachel's mind as she realizes what she's seeing. He stands up from where he fell just inside the door, no longer feels weak and does not need to lean against the wall. Looking around the room wide-eyed, he finally breaks her silence and demands loudly, "What the hell is going on? Is that..." She can't even finish the last question. She knows the answer. Joy, with her normally sensitive nature, stops her cleaning to introduce Rachel and the body. She points a shovel at the body on the plastic, and she, while pointing at Rachel with her free hand, "Rob, meet Rachel. Rachel, meet Rob. You'll have to excuse him. He's not real talkative right now." "Joy," Lisa exclaims while shooting her a scolding look. "Rachel, did Allison not explain what this is?" Allison explains, "Tried to talk her out of coming. You should have told her what this he was coming to."
Wow.
Fantastic. Nicely
read. I love the little bits of humor in there, you know. It's not like we could tell them, you know, hold on, we got to put this plastic down. That was great.
Yeah. Well, it's practical as well, which I like. I like practical, you know. And it always puts me in mind of, was it The Goodfellas, where Joe Pesci walks into the room expecting he was going to get a promotion or something, and there's all the plastic laid down. And the minute he walks in and you see all the plastic, you know. You know what's coming, you know, and it's great. I love that.
That was good. So is it going to be, is there a sequel or is it, you know, done with?
There may be a sequel. I mean, I've got ideas, to build onto it. I mean, really this kind of introduces the group and the concept around what's going on and really develops the characters. So whether it goes on, you know, the concept I have around the sequel, not necessarily taking Rachel forward, but it's more Joy. Joy, you know, you see everything through Rachel's eyes, but
mm-hmm.
Joy is really the center. You know, she's the organizer. She's the one that's really, she's an attorney. She suffered, you know, at the hands of her, you know, oppressive husband who was also an attorney. She's tried every legal aspect to feel safe, you know, from what he did to her. And he's the one that finally reached that limit of there's only one way, you know, and this is how, you know, this is what you have to do. And she's kind of developed this order, you know, of women to do this. So, if it goes forward into a sequel, it'll definitely be more around Joy and maybe even some backstory into some of the other women, you know, more, you know, like a retrospective look, you
right.
know, to the group.
Now,
so,
I know
yep.
that, you know, a lot of people, a big question that people always get is, where did you get your idea from? And I'm pretty curious, so what would make you write about the subject matter?
Well, like I said, I don't really write things that are pushing any sort of moral or social agenda. You know, it's more of, I try to take a real situation and expand on it and make it kind of horrifying and terrifying, because I think, you know, that is even worse, you know, as to a reader when they're reading it, it's like, oh my God, this is real. You know, it's not like,
yeah.
okay, we've got werewolves chasing me. You know, no, this
right.
is something that, you know, could be real. So most of my words were that. On this particular one, I know a few people have gone through things. I know a lot of people or some people have gone through situations where they've had to get like orders of personal protection, and then they've had cops
yeah.
basically tell them, it's a piece of paper. What do you want me to do? You know, so there really isn't a legal, you know, protection. So, you know, it kind of started off as that and then kept working, you know, deeper into the story.
Awesome. That really, I want to read it. I do. Especially the gory scenes. You did that really well with the gray and the, you know, the blood and brain matter I'm picturing. That was really awesome.
Cool. I will say that the one thing that I'll point out also, I did get a review that's since been removed off of Amazon because it violated Amazon's terms because the person got a little personal with me. But I kind of take it as a badge of honor from a horror writer and what this was supposed to be. This is supposed to be kind of a neurotic, psychological, you know, experimentation. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, the review put out there, this author obviously has emotional issues that he needs professional help with. I'm like, they got it. They actually understood what I was trying to do. You know, so yeah. So if you want to read something that's obviously sick enough, you know, sick and disturbing enough to make someone leave that type of review,
yeah.
this is the book for you. You know, so I don't know what better review a horror author could get. Oh, this
is
book
perfect,
made me think
yeah.
of rainbows and butterflies. Yeah, no.
Yeah, then you failed miserably.
Yeah, yeah. No,
yeah.
This person is sick and needs professional help. All right, there we go.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much, indeed.
I know that one of my early reviews for Dark Musing said something that it sounded like love letters that I'd penned to Charles Manson, and I thought that was pretty cool. I mean, I was
yeah.
like, thank you. That's awesome. I mean. Yeah, not that I'm a huge fan or anything, but that was really kind of cool.
Yeah,
I think sometimes
people miss the point. I mean, I've had some review, and part of my favorite one was the one, the guy who had a go at me for using big words. I think he was obviously a seventh grader writing in, you know, and I've had, people this was sick, this was da-da-da, and you must be a sick individual. And then you said, it's all made up, you knob. I made it up.
What?
You know, and I think people don't seem to differentiate that it's pretend. We don't actually do this stuff. We don't kill people.
Yeah.
We don't shoot zombies. We don't murder. It's all make-believe, people.
I'm not writing stuff I'd want to do or stuff that I enjoy. I'm writing stuff that I would enjoy reading myself. That's where my stories, you know, come
well,
from.
Actually, David, no, I do write things that I would like to do. I mean, I must have murdered my ex-wife in many guises over the years. So sometimes I write and because I've written it, it kind of it sort of quietens the voices in my head. So
yes,
it does help.
Yes. That's the reason that we don't murder people. We write about it. That's what I think.
Exactly.
Maybe I do have some emotional issues that I need professional help with, considering you guys made a reference to like Jack and Jill earlier being related to virginity. One of the first things I actually wrote, which was actually published in a Hellbound anthology, was a horror version of how Jack and Jill ended. let's just say pruning shears and being de-skinned. You know,
I remember that.
Yes. Maybe I do have some mental issues I need to, you know, get addressed. You know, so.
Maybe well, you know, it's perhaps if you had them addressed, you wouldn't be such a good horror writer. So leave them. Just leave them be.
Yeah. I was actually. We have not had in a couple of weeks. I don't think we've done either one of the, you know, embarrassing stories or the 11 questions. And I do think that David had an embarrassing story for us.
Oh, fantastic! Well, I'll tell you, we'll do the full on. We'll do the jingle first, shall we? I think we should. We should.
Hi, I'm Patty, and I'm Thelma. What is your most embarrassing story?
All right, embarrassing stories. So, not me directly, but I was involved, and there's two different flavors. In my household, thanks to my wife, which both of you guys know, she'll make herself known to you guys later. That's with you guys all the time on Facebook. She has a problem in ordering food, and usually I'm at the other end of it. Let's see, there's either the jalapenos, peppers that were not to be put on the pizza, you know, that I'm sitting there talking to her and ordering on Domino's, and the person on the other end of the phone hears that. It's like, did she just say jalapenos? Yes, welcome to our household. And then there's also, we're sitting at a very fancy Italian restaurant, you know, one of the big chain stores, you know, Olive Garden, and Carrabba's, and she ordered pasta weenie instead of pasta weenie. I thought the waiter was going to crack up, and then, of course, as I'm walking back to the bathroom past him, I hear him telling the other waiters, that's the guy whose wife asked for the pasta weenie. And I was like, oh, God. I just buried my head and kept walking, you know. So.
That's awesome. I think I love her. We have to have her on the show. That's great.
Yeah,
oh,
so those are the embarrassing. It's food order,
yeah.
You know, stories in our household.
Yeah.
Those never go well.
We are just about out of time, and the show went by way too fast. Can you tell us where we can find you online?
Yeah, so I do have an author profile on Amazon. You can find me, you know, there if you go to one of my books and click it. If you just do a search for David Clark and you come to the one that is a self-help author, that is not me. You do not want the one that's going to tell you how to better yourself. You want to find the one that's going to tell you how to, you know, de-skin your girlfriend or wife with printing shears. Or you can also find me at David Clark Carr at Facebook. I do have a Facebook page that's out, also out there. So those are the two places I can be found.
Awesome. And you have to promise to come back and see us.
Absolutely.
Great, thank you. James was just doing his weird demon voice thingy, so I think he's muted himself. I'm not sure if he's coming back or not, but this is normally the time of the show when James would tell me to say goodnight, Xtina. So goodnight, Xtina.